Hello, Lewis.
Yeah, hi.
Okay, so let's get started. We should talk about the prototype and simulation experiments first, and then we can talk about the paper.
Okay, so I'm just in the process of running the experiments, but some of the figures I'm not sure if I understand exactly what you want for some of the figures, so I think maybe it's a good idea. So do we go figure by figure for the experiments?
Okay.
So I know exactly what to plot.
Okay.
First, for figure one, you want, when you say per hour overlap, you mean that we use the normal, the regular history, but the thing we're going to overlap against the regular history is 1 hour.
Actually, no, what we need to do is, actually, there is a comment by Akshat in which he's, I think now I read, he says 1 hour. That's not how I imagined it, but I would like let Akshat first say what he meant about the 1 hour comment. And then,
okay, so what I really meant, so this thing, the what's supposed to capture, as far as I could see, was let's say you have a 30-day trace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you pick some 1 hour in that 30 days. Let's say pick the first hour on the 29th day.
Okay.
And then you try to figure out the overlap that has with the previous 1 day, previous 7 days, previous 14 days, previous 3 days, 7 days. So for 1 day, you basically do the 28th day.
Okay.
As the history, and the first hour of the 29th as the evaluation, as the overlap time. For 2 days, you take 27, 28 and do the first hour. For 3 days, similarly, 26, 27, 28. And so, of course, so that's how it's done. And then the different lines are, of course, there's no confusion with that, or do you have some confusion on that as well?
No, that's fine. I'll change it to bar so we can have multiple series and we can easily see. No, that's fine. My question really is, we have the numbers for 1 day. I'll have to repeat it for an hour because I just saw that comment that says about the hour.
Okay, so that's also fine. Maybe keep it. So the reason I wanted to keep for 1 hour or 2 hour, so 1 hour is just a placeholder for a small interval. So what I wanted to study was the kind of hit rate that you will see in the consolidation window. And the consolidation window we have defined as 1 hour or 2 hours. So that's the only reason. There's no other reason. But this is a justification. It doesn't need to have a one-to-one correspondence. So I don't know, maybe you can just keep it at the end, and if there is time, then do it for 1 hour, otherwise.
Okay, because on the long run, we will see pretty much the same numbers, right, if we use 2 hours or a day, right?
Yeah, the numbers should not be very different, even if you do 1 hour versus 1 day. I also don't see plot changing much.
Okay.
So Ricardo, can you describe how you got the numbers in the current graph?
It's pretty much the way you said. For example, for 14 days, I use from day 1 to 14, and then as a history, and then I replay the traces for day 15.
Mm-hmm.
And compute the misses, compute the hits, pretty much everything. And then I use 1 to 16 and 1 to 15 and use 16 and as the day I use to replay traces. And that for, 3, average of 3 except for 20 in which case you only have one run.
Okay, so now when you say that you compute an overlap, do you compute overlap for reads or both reads and writes?
We have the three options, but the thing that's plotted here, it's only reads and hits of reads against reads and writes of everything until the moment the request is sent.
Oh, I see. Okay, so
in
that,
this case,
that is what would be
three.
With our system, right? That
yes,
that shows the benefit of using our system.
Exactly, yes. Yes, in figure one will be sub three. I. Yep.
Figure one will be what?
The option three reads with reads and writes historical and recent offloaded writes.
So, but you're saying that you're using recent offloaded writes and the reads, correct?
Oh yeah, and reads. Yes, that's true. Oh, yes, that's
so,
true. Yes.
So this is because with if we want to estimate the benefit with write offloading, in write offloading, the recent reads should not be used for overlap because they don't offload the recent reads.
Okay.
So this is the one that you have on the figure is not really number three.
Yes,
it's maybe number four.
Okay. Yeah. That's true. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So.
Yeah.
So number one. So if we walk through, the four. Earlier we had three, but now you have a fourth one, which is what you have in the graph.
Yeah.
The first one is reads and writes. With the historical reads and writes, so you don't
mm-hmm.
take any recent IO into account, and plus you can measure overlap with both reads and writes.
Yeah.
So that's number one. That should have, in some sense, the lowest overlap, because you want to overlap with both reads and writes, and you only overlap with the history. And then number two is you overlap only reads with the historical
yeah.
reads and writes. So all previous days with the reads of the current day.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, that's for these figures. I saw that on figure two you already changed it.
Yeah, I made it a different figure now.
Yeah.
Just put everything in the one figure, but I'm not sure if this is the best way to show it. There was a suggestion by Akshat to normalize the numbers. There are some benefits and of normalizing the numbers that then we can show, for instance, that the intensity is not synchronized more easily if we normalize the numbers. But what we cannot show then is the variance, the variation in the intensity levels across the workloads. So I'm not yet sure which one we should put, so I'm open to suggestions if we should keep the current one that we have as figure two or use a normalized version instead.
Okay.
Actually, the normalized one will have another problem. Right now, just because the levels are different, you can still make them out a little bit.
Mm.
If you normalize them, they will all kind of go on top of each other.
Right. So I wrote up something using the current figure, which I don't know if that... I think it covers most of the motivation-related items that we wanted to use this graph for. So I'm okay to leave it as it is, and maybe you know, on a different reading, if we feel that this needs to be changed, we can change it.
Yeah, this looks okay to me as well now.
I haven't printed it in black and white though, so if it doesn't print well, then I'll change the lines.
Yeah, actually, it doesn't print well. WebVM and Homes are just too close for us to figure out. Yeah, also because they overlap a little bit. So I guess we'll have to think of something about how to make it readable, but.
Yeah, but yeah, we can, I guess, do that. But as long as we are in agreement on this graph itself, I think we can change the other details.
Yeah, this looks okay to me, at least.
Okay. All right, so figure two then is taken care of. The figure three is the one that would be motivating as beyond write offloading, right? So that's in some sense showing that the read misses are sort of close enough or in some sense require the disk to be spun up quite frequently, which is not good for reliability. I think in some sense the reliability angle is our key differentiator with write offloading is what I see.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is what sort of how do we get this? We need to have time information, correct? In some sense, we need the CDF of inter-read miss times. If we have that, then
What's the format of the trace? If that information is there in the trace, right? The time?
the time information
yes.
is there, yes.
Okay, then yeah, then it should be fairly straightforward. What I can do is I'm not sure if how large the traces are, but I can write up something and test it on a small segment of. So if one of you can just check in a small segment of the trace, I can write
Okay.
something in for that, and then maybe you can play it on the larger traces.
Okay. To be precise, like how many megs or of traces?
Maybe just 1 meg. 1 meg should be good enough.
Okay. And then I'll send you right now.
Just add it to the CVS, maybe. That's probably
Okay.
will help, right?
Okay.
And I think here we are looking for individual volume traces rather than the merged one, right?
Yeah.
So just let's say just I don't know which one. I guess we need all three of them in some sense. So we have CDF for all three.
Yes, we'll have to do it for all three.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so I guess the CDF of inter-arrival time of read misses should be reasonable, right? Or
Yes,
some.
that's yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, that's what we'll need. Although what we can do is instead of plotting the so what we are saying is that you define an idle interval and figure out if no request comes in that idle interval or not. Now we can change the definition of the idle interval as well. So the CDF of the read miss is in some sense broken into discrete in steps. That's at least what I had in mind. So because what we also want to show is that like the write offloading paper, the insight that they have is true, but it's true only as long as you're looking to switch off things for a minute. And so even in our traces, that insight holds that for very small intervals, you can create idleness by offloading writes. but you really can't do it for longer intervals. So that's why we kind of also was thinking that to study it for very small and large intervals as well.
So I mean, if we do a CDF of inter-arrival times for read misses, does that address all the I mean, does that give us enough information to answer many questions, or we'll need something other than the CDF?
Actually, what? Yeah, that should probably answer everything. That should answer everything.
Right. So what that would tell us, let's say.
Yeah, because what I currently was thinking of plotting was 5 points on that CDF and just interpolating between them. You are talking of computing the whole CDF.
Right, so the question is how, if the computing the entire CDF is going to take prohibitive amount of time or not. Yes, or it, can we approximate it with just 5 points in an easy way? I mean, is it simple to do that and run a faster simulation, or it would take the same amount of time anyway?
Yeah, the CDF thing, I'm not sure exactly how to code it up, but the other thing is very straightforward. The other thing is just a linear run, so it doesn't even need to store anything. It just defines an idle period and does one run. So it reads the data once. That's all that it needs to do. And for 5 points, it needs to read the data 5 times. For a CDF, we will probably have to keep some amount of history.
Well, what I was thinking is that, let's say you run the simulator and you know the read miss events, correct? And each time you have a read miss, you spit out a time number, which is the difference between the time of the current read miss and the previous read miss. So in some sense, the inter-arrival time since the previous one. And then you have a whole bunch of inter-arrival times that you can generate a CDF out of.
Yeah, the catch is that the simulator is also keeping replicas, and it's having a read miss when you don't get a hit on the replica also.
Oh, I see.
This particular case, yeah, so...
I see, okay, yeah. That's true. So this is a modified version of what we have.
Yeah, this is just plain write offloading and nothing else. What we have done is build something on top of it. So.
Okay. Yeah. So Akshat, if you want to take a lead on this, you know, that would certainly be great.
Yeah, so let me think about it and come up with some solution, and we can then iterate on it if required.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Another question I had asked is on the simulator, in order to just 1 second. Okay, for the power consumption prediction, the numbers we are generating to get the power is are mainly the time that each disk is on, off, and the number of times each disk is being turned on and off. We haven't measured anything from the disks yet in order to model the power consumption of the disks and get the total number. Because I'm not really sure how to do it.
So, I mean, the way I was thinking about this, Ricardo, is that there will be, let's say, 5 different numbers that you need to get.
The thing is that I don't think... for example, if we get, I'm not sure if I'm using the units right. That's my problem. For example, if I measure watts at a specific time, for example, while I'm turning on a disk, is it just a matter of multiplying that number by the number of seconds that operation took.
Yes, so I think
But that's the
watts.
way you should do it.
I think watts is energy divided by time, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's joules per second.
Yeah.
So the final number we'll have is total energy consumed, right?
That would be the yeah. That would make sense. Or power. I mean, we just divide by
Okay.
time, but if the time is not constant, then you're right that the joules is what we should measure.
Okay, so it's really not power consumed, it's
It's energy consumed.
energy consumed.
Yes.
Yeah, no, but okay, but if you look at figure 9 and 10, then they're supposed to be time series plots. So in that case, you what you
Okay,
mean?
yes.
So
That's
it's
true.
instantaneous power at that particular time.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh, that's easier. Okay. Okay, that's fine. So it's really watts. Okay.
So one thing which you need to also keep in mind is that some of these operations have a latency, right? I mean, spin up has a latency,
Oh, so
and you need to measure in some sense the average power so that you can feed it into the simulator both pieces of information, the latency and the power. So you can come up with the correct time series plot as well, or the total energy consumed. In both cases, you will need that.
Okay, because for example, from the simulator we're getting the number of reads, the number of writes, and number of misses, number of everything, but for example, for figure 11, then I mean, it's not only based on information from the simulator, we need to use the latency we get from replaying traces at different speeds multiplied by the number of reads and writes we measure from the simulator, right?
So which plot are you talking of?
Now,
9, 10?
I'm on figure 11, plot 11.
So 11 I think is an energy plot and not a power plot, because this we are so in the here the x-axis is the different arrival rates and the y-axis is the some measure of power. So either it could be average power or energy. Either of
Okay.
these would be fine. So what you're saying is, if you can plot 9 and 10, then 11 is nothing else but you just sum up everything for 9, all the different values, and take the average, and maybe that's good enough. In the case of 9, it's slightly tricky. It's not that straightforward, because what you are getting numbers is you are getting that the number of disks that are active in each period. Now the periods are like 1 hour or 2 hours, whatever. I'm not sure what you're running at, but your spikes are at a very short duration. So this thing should be plotted at the like so the x-axis the every you need probably need to plot a point for every second something, and then during the periods of so if you are switching off a disk or switching on a disk, then the power spike there will be a power spike during that period, and then it will stabilize and all that. So in order to capture that, your granularity should be 1 second, and so it will be fairly stable for some time. Then you see like either a burst up or a burst down or whatever it is for during the transition, and then fairly stable for some time. So is that what you had in mind, or
No, but now it's clear.
yeah? And the moment you have plotted 9 and 10, what you just need to do is take the y-axis for all of these, add them up, divide by the number of points you have, and that's it. And for
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Okay, so another thing, for example, for figure 9 and 10, we would like to see like all the SLA intervals of an interval, something like 1 every 2 hours for a day, right? Something like that. I mean, that's a complete period of time you want to see on the figures.
yeah, it It probably should be a few, at least a few consolidation intervals. So if your consolidation interval is 1 hour, then you probably want to sit at least for 5, 6 hours. And if it's 2 hours, then maybe for
Okay.
8, 10 hours.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. Okay, that's that. Okay, figure 12, 13, that's fine. Figure 14, I would say. Could we check figure 14, please?
Yeah. So this is assuming, now I'm not sure whether it's possible in the current simulation, but this is kind of saying that how do we do with scalability? So assume that you initially had just 4 disk or 8 disk in your setup, and then you increase it to like 16 disk and all that. And then can we do we ideally the more the number of disk, we should at least perform as well or slightly better. That's the kind of observation I was hoping to make. So I'll give you an example. So assume that you have 4 disks with capacity C each, and you put the traces through them. Or you have 8 disks with capacity C by 2, and then you put the traces through them. In both cases, the average load is more or less same, but fragmentation and the granularity level is different, right? So,
Same
so
to
you want
better,
to
but
s
sorry.
yeah. So pretty much that's all that you want to do. You want to see with 4 disks how much power savings you get, for 8 disks how much power savings you get, and savings are basically the power by hour method versus the baseline power, the difference. And
Okay. Okay,
so
that's fine.
that,
So
so I think that seems to be of a second order of priority experiment, if I'm not mistaken. Seems like
yeah, I guess, yeah, this is the last one in the simulator, so of course it's anyway, I guess, the last one. 15 and 16 are, I guess, these are prototype experiments, right? So
right, that's true. And 15 and 16 are prototype experiments. There might be something which we can also show for real power measurements during the prototype run, if we have the ability to do that.
Yeah, we can do
Yeah, that would be good.
that.
And
Actually,
actually, we would need us. Just one comment. We probably would also need a small table in here which captures the power values that we are using based on the experiment. So that small table, even though it's not there, we probably need to add.
so that those are the numbers being used in the simulator, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, I guess, Ricardo, you are still in the process of measuring these numbers, correct?
Yes, just one more question. We are using 20 days as history, but as we've seen, that requires a lot of, well, actually, I don't know, so 20 days is fine. I
If
mean, as
20,
much day as we can, that's the number we want.
in some sense, I mean, when I was writing the paper, I was thinking that the what would make sense was that for each different workload, you use a different history based on how stable the workload is. I mean, we don't, for instance,
Okay.
in a real system, you probably will not use the same history for all the workloads, right? But in our case, we could just go with that, if that makes things easier, to use the longest history among all the workloads, which I think is for the
Home.
homes. Yeah. So
Yeah.
for that you need 20 days. In fact, the history is probably longer than 20 days, if I'm not mistaken, because the curve is still going up,
Yeah.
even after 20 days. So probably 1 month would be more like it, but we don't have I'm assuming that we don't have numbers for 1 month, right?
No, we have.
So we just go with 20. We just go
okay.
with 20 days, and if it's easy to do 20 days for everything, then just do that. In reality, what should happen is that for each workload, we use a different time granularity, depending on how stable it is. For instance, for online, the webmail and online, we should probably be using, I don't know, maybe 1 week instead of 20 days.
Okay, something we're not considering is the size is the complexity of getting these overlap blocks, right?
Yeah, that's true, and in some sense it's not in the critical path, so we can argue that it can be it's a background activity.
But it requires a lot of memory, that's the problem.
It requires a lot of memory, that's true, but you can argue that, well, in some settings it is okay to use that much memory if you can see significant performance benefit as a consequence of using so much memory.
And it's a one-time thing, right?
Well, you need to maintain somewhere the list of logs that we are accessing, right?
You mean the indirection, the map?
That's pretty much all you need, right? So,
the size of the map is something we need to report in the paper. So, I'm assuming that Lewis is collecting that information as he runs the prototype experiment.
I wanted to do that, but I'm not certain how to do it. I was thinking about doing some kind of timeline of the memory usage while the experiment run, but that won't be very accurate, right? I know that most of the memory used would be from the map, but
The other option is to measure that in the simulator, which we anyway have that information available. Because memory, just because you'll probably be measuring active memory, and that is not like responsive. So even if you're not using some memory, it takes a little bit of time for it to be reclaimed and all that. Unless you, in the background, you're also running some kind of a reclamation process.
The problem with that is that the way we implemented the simulator, we're using a lot of memory. And for example, right now I'm running some experiments and I'm using like 80% of 100 gigs of memory.
Actually, but that's because of a little bit. So a little bit of is that is also because we later we almost went for a brute force design. We get whole trace and then we do it. But we can, in theory, there is no problem in basically splitting that trace into smaller parts and computing the metrics for each part and then keep on appending to them. So it's probably just not such a big deal as I see it.
Okay.
But I mean, just to clarify, we don't want to measure the entire processed memory. We want to, measure only the memory requirement of the map itself.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the amount of memory that will be needed continuously through the running of the system.
Okay, so something I'm dumping is the size of the size of the complete working set we have until that moment. So the memory requirement is proportional to that, right?
Yeah, so the number of bits that Lewis keeps for each block, that multiplied with the number of blocks, that's all that you need to have.
Okay, so we have that information, that's fine.
Yeah, well, actually, take into account, I don't have I mean, I have 1 bit per process, but I'm using the same 32 bits integer, right? So actually, with one integer of 4 bytes, you can keep the bit information of 32 disks for one block. So I guess that will reduce the memory usage.
Okay, so I'll get those numbers and then we can sit together and do the math.
Right. So I remember that for Borg and also for Excess, we did some kind of worst case scenario calculation where we say if we have, in the case of Borg, if we have the OPT full of blocks, then we will have this amount of memory usage, something like that. So I don't know if we want to do something like that or...
Well, what we could do is come up with a formula similar to what we use for Borg, given that we have a certain amount of replica scratch space and size of the working set and things like that, right? So we could do some, we can just present some to sort of give the reader some impression of the costs involved and what are the various factors that contribute to the memory cost. So I think the one factor is the size of the working set, the other is the size of the scratch, then number of replicas, because there is 1 bit per block per replica, right, for the dirty information. And we can come up with a formula based on that, these three parameters.
Yeah.
And okay, we could add this formula in the same section where we present the actual memory utilization numbers.
Okay,
Hello.
Yeah. Another question I had. I've been running anything without partitioning the disks. It was fast and easier. But I just realized that one of the disks has too many loads. So I don't know.
I see. Okay. So.
I think I have to reduce some stuff.
That's probably cheater, right? I mean...
Yeah, as cheat is the problem.
Yeah, and in some sense, the way we are writing the paper is being written is that we are always talking about sub-replicas and partitioning of the disk. I think you would probably find that there is almost necessary to do that, right? In the case of the at least the one trace that we have.
Yeah. Yep.
So how many disks are you simulating, Ricardo?
We have, let me copy that information, just one sec. We have this...
We have nine disks.
Okay. Okay. So, and this correspond to the original disk, and it's not as if you're simulating.
Yeah, we haven't spreaded anything. It's the original stuff.
Okay.
So there are many of these discs that are that have a lot of plenty empty space and unused bandwidth. A lot of unused bandwidth. So it's good. And it's not an artificial scenario. It's the real scenario.
Okay, that's fine. When you try to consolidate, what's like the ballpark that you see? How many do you end up with?
On this nine, with the maximum band with the maximum bandwidth we said about the sequential throughput, we end up with 2-3 disks.
Okay, and in the worst case, with the peak as the bound or something like that.
Yeah, that's the thing I'm running right now.
Okay, fine, that's fine.
Yeah.
So the Cheetah disk is probably going to be continuously on, right?
Yep, that's what I'm saying, because it cannot fit anywhere else.
Mm.
Well, it can fit, but it's not being replicated. I mean, offloaded.
It seems like there would be very little reason to offload Cheetah. If its working set size is large, and the disk is continuously using a lot of bandwidth, would make sense to just leave it alone, not to mess with it, right? I mean, even in the real system.
Yes.
So Cheetah is the male one, or which one is this?
Yeah, it's the male one. It's the largest
one. Okay. Yeah, and the working set is also not very, very stable, as opposed to the WebVM, which is very stable.
Yes.
So WebVM is the one that should probably always move around, because it's a very stable working set.
Yeah, that's true. That information we won't see on the figures, which disks are being moving. Or things like that. It's something we want to consider.
It may not be in the figures, but we can always mention in the text. These are like insights that you can provide, even though they're not in the figure.
Okay.
In the explanation in the text, we will do. As long as you have the information in your head, I think that's okay.
Okay, that's fine. Okay.
So is there a figure where we show the number of active disks over time? Or something like that?
No, I haven't plotted anything.
Although the
power
figure...
I mean for the future paper, okay. But the power... Sorry?
Go on.
I mean, we get that information from the... from figure 9, for example, right? I mean, we'll see like steps. That means that we're turning on a disk or things like that.
Yeah. That's what I was also.
I see. Yeah.
We could annotate the figure, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, but if you're collecting that information, that would be then easy to add on. I don't know if we're collecting that information.
Yeah. Actually, we are measuring the. We're getting the power consumption based on that information.
Okay. All right. So then we can add it on as if we think it's necessary.
Okay.
All right. So Ricardo, do you have any more questions about what you're doing?
I don't have anything in mind right now, but I think that's pretty much all I have.
Okay, so maybe we can talk about what Lewis is doing, and then if you remember anything, we can go back.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So, talking about the prototype, as I sent the email, I solved the problem. I already implemented the solution. So now the prototype is really, it's it behaves very, very similar to a real system, right? So now I only synchronize those replicas that need to be synchronized, including the write buffer, right? So So I think that's solved. I tested yesterday and it works. At least the few tests I did work perfectly fine. So we're good on
okay,
that.
Did you do, I'm assuming you also did some synchronization operations, right?
Yeah, of course. I was
okay.
Before I was doing synchronization operations, but my synchronization was to send the blocks back to their fixed location. And
I see.
And then, you know, again, probably, yeah, exactly. So right now what I'm doing is exactly as it should be done. That is, if I'm moving the replica to another replica, then if that replica is not up to date, I, you know, send the write to that new replica and so on. And that also happened for the write buffer, which is a little bit trickier, okay? So at this point, let me see, at this point, the only thing I'm doing, the only thing missing, I guess, is that, and I think it's easily fixable, but I don't know if we have the time or we have to fix it, is that when, I guess there are cases where you do not use the replica of one block, let's say, but rather you go back to your linear or original location, right? I guess that case is when the replica is turned off and it turns out that your fixed, your the disk of the block fixed location is turned on again. Does that make sense?
So you're saying the active replica is turned off?
Yeah, the active replica is turned. Let me see. The block where your the fixed location of the block, let's say some block, right? The fixed location of some block. Okay, this is hard to
no,
say.
No, no, no.
So,
I mean, let me get this straight. Are you saying that the active replica of a block can be turned off? I don't think that's even a possibility.
Yeah, but I'm saying that the replica is turned off in favor of turning on the fixed location disk. So
oh, this is a transition.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so you change the active replica, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, then if you change the active replica, you do synchronization.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, there was something that you said earlier that was not really how I was thinking about this, which is
okay.
Active replica can never be turned off unless you do change of active replica first. So you've changed the active replica, then you can switch off the previous active replica if needed.
Yeah, that's true. But what I'm saying is that I guess there would be cases where you turn off all the replicas, right, that you have, and you work with your fixed location.
Okay.
Original location. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so, Luis, are you saying that in case you have an active replica on and then you want to move to the primary disk, the original disk on which data was there?
Exactly.
Even in that case, when...
Hello?
Copy, and you need to do a synchronization anyway.
Right. So, exactly. So, what I'm doing is that in that case, I'm writing... I'm not checking, actually, I can do that, but I don't know exactly how, but I'm not checking if the data is the same. I'm just moving from the replica to their original location, and that's all.
Yeah, okay. So you probably, again, just need to do the same thing, that all the dirty blocks, you just need to synchronize, and that's it. The rest you can skip.
Yeah, I guess it's fine. I guess I can implement that, so it's not an issue. It's very easy actually. I think I can. I know how to do it. Okay. So well, other than that, so that means that the prototype is mostly done, I guess.
So Louis, just one clarification, because you said something which made me think about this, which is that the timeouts,
mm-hmm.
you know, timeout for powering down.
Mm-hmm.
Should only be set up for the disk that actually turned off. Right, so the active disk should not have a timeout.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
okay,
exactly right.
Okay, so all right, so we are on the same page on that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, good.
Yeah.
About that, in the simulator, you're using 1 minute as timeout. I don't know if that makes sense.
You should talk to Lewis. What is the timeout interval, Lewis? The minimum timeout interval?
The minimum timeout interval is 5 seconds. But I guess we don't want 5 seconds because probably, it will make the disk to spin up and down very frequently, right?
Okay. So, so what are you using now?
Right now, I haven't started experiments. That's the other steps I'm doing right now. I'm setting up the whole machines and the ATA over Ethernet thing, so we can do the experiments, right? I hope today I can have something.
What timeout are you using again?
No, I'm not using a timeout right now because I haven't.
Okay.
I haven't started experiments.
Okay, so what timeout do you think is a good idea?
Yeah, I was thinking.
What did you use in Nexus?
In Nexus, we test several timeouts, and the best one was 5 seconds. Okay, but
yeah.
The problem with 5 seconds is that you will destroy your disk very easily. So I would say, and the thing is that this is very long. The idea is to have 2 hours interval, right? Between synchronizations and
yes.
Between synchronization. So I guess 1 minute or two is fine, I would say.
So Luis, one comment there. What we are doing here is, in some sense, we are also telling that this can be switched off and this can be switched on. So if we can automatically set the timeout, then ideally what we'd want to do is for those disks that we are asking to be switched off, we can set a very low timeout because we believe that traffic will come to them. And the disk that we are going to keep on, we probably need to have a large timeout. So even in case of, let's say if there is some sudden idleness, even then they should not be switched off. So does that make sense?
Okay, so Akshat, it doesn't make sense to me. I think what you just said was that we should have timeouts on active disks also?
There will be timeouts, right? Because
That's a choice that we can make,
okay.
Which is to have a timeout or not on each disk and how much the timeout should be. So if we don't have a timeout, then the disk will never be switched off.
Okay.
No,
I would say that
we need to keep the active disks on because otherwise we will have probably high latencies if the disk is off, and we also will incur in the maximum number of spin ups that the disk has, right? Which in turns out that well, in the case of Xs was not that bad. Because I remember that in the disks of a laptop, for a laptop, is the number of spins up is a lot higher than for desktops. So I think in the desktop we need to have, or well, in this case in the server we need to be more careful. In the number of spins up and down.
Right, so I don't think there are, most servers are using timeout intervals for precisely that reason that desktop drives are much less resilient to spin up and spin down. So if we know for sure that a disk is going to be, you know, accessed with very low probability for a long duration, then we can set a timeout for that. But if it's an active disk, we probably should not use any timeout at all.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So then we can stick to 5 seconds, right, for inactive disks? And
yeah. I think 5 seconds is okay because, in some sense, what we are saying is that that disk is very likely to be not used in quite some time. And I also see what Lewis' point is, that if it's going to be inactive for 2 hours, then it really doesn't matter if you use 5 seconds or 1 minute, because the amount of savings is not going to be significant by using 5 seconds. So either way is fine. I think 5 seconds is okay, or 30 seconds or 1 minute is also okay, but it doesn't, I don't think it really matters.
We can okay. Also do some analysis, and probably this is better because we have some numbers, right? We can see how much time we need to have the disk on in order to compensate the energy spent spinning up the disk. Right, because when you spin up the disk, you have a peak in the usage of energy. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a good idea too. So keep the spin out interval based on the spin up duration and power consumption.
Right.
I agree. So we could do that, and I think this timeout interval is not so critical anyway. So. You can do anything that you think is reasonable.
Okay.
So, Ricardo, using 1 minute in your simulator is okay. If you want to use something smaller, also it's fine. I think it really makes.
I'm already running some stuff, so.
Yeah.
One
so
minute
just.
Is fine, I guess.
Okay, just use 1 minute. I don't think it will matter all that much.
Okay.
So Ricardo, it takes too long to complete an iteration, or how much time does it take?
In 20 days, right now, the stuff I've been running already took an hour.
Okay, that's a lot. Okay.
Okay, so Lewis, I guess you were working on the last two figures, right?
Yes, exactly. So I'm planning also to get the energy from the prototype. It's a matter, it's not complicated. So just to get those numbers as well.
Okay.
So let
okay,
me see.
I think there is one portion of the paper that needs to be, maybe input from you guys, which is the experimental setup. In terms of how the what instruments we are using, how we connecting them, and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we started to do that yesterday. It started some time back, but yesterday was most of the work done. And what we are doing is to have two machines, okay? Because as I said, I tried to connect 8 disks in the same machine, and it didn't work. So, and actually, now that I think about it, right now we have only 8 ports, so 7 serial ATA and 8 and 1 IDE. So, at this point, we cannot connect more than 8 disks. So we need to think more about this. But I have one machine where I want to connect. I want to run the replay, right? And another machine that will be at the server of ATA over Ethernet. Okay?
That okay.
It's a low overhead SAN-like server or protocol.
Okay.
So if we need an additional disk, probably I can set up another machine with ATA over Ethernet. So what I'm doing right now is that I pull out from the case, I pulled out the cables we need, right? Like the serial LTA cables and the IDE cable.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is to connect all the disks to the same power supply, which is separate from the machine's power supply, right? So we just have the disk in a separate power supply, and we can measure the power of just the power consumption of only the disks. So I'm planning to connect all the disks in the same power supply and measure the power of that, the power consumption of that power supply.
Okay.
With the experiment, that's what I think.
And the other meter is being used by Ricardo for the calibration.
No, we've done it directly.
I see. So you do on one disk, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Or each separate disk, or something like that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Hold on one second.
Well, so that's what I have. That's what I'm planning to work next. So after I have all the machines set up and everything, I will start running some experiments and see what happens.
Okay, so all right. So have we covered all the graphs? I mean, this between the two of you, except for maybe one or two which are low priority.
Yeah, I guess, right.
Okay, all right.
Yep.
Okay, that's good. So
one thing. So I am planning to just collect the block trace from the experiments and collect the power consumption, right, from the power meter. So do you think that is enough, or should I have something else?
I guess you need to measure the latencies, right? I mean, I'm assuming that you're doing that in also.
But the latencies can be done from the block trace, right? It's not an issue.
Correct. Yeah. So
okay.
So block trace also allows you to measure ATA over Ethernet?
That's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question.
So that would be important.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know about that.
Probably it will, because you're issuing all the IO requests from one location, right? Anyway, that's important. That's very important for us to check. So that's
okay.
One, the latency. And so when we measure the latency, we need to measure the latency of the foreground IO. So that is without the synchronization IO. So that's another.
That is hard to measure. How? Because mixing all the operations. In the same trace, right? And I think we have discussed this before. And the thing is that at the event level, you don't have process information. And
so we could measure. Okay. So, but even if you had process information, it doesn't matter because it's all coming from one process. You cannot distinguish.
Exactly. That's what's my next problem. Yeah.
I see. So that's a bit of an issue. But I guess let me think about this. Is there a way to measure the latencies during and outside of synchronization intervals?
Say that again?
Can you measure latencies in the, just like we have reconfiguration phases, these are synchronization phases, right?
Right.
So can you measure the latencies outside of these synchronization phases and within the synchronization phases separately?
That seems hard to do. I guess we can, right? But yeah, I don't know about that.
Just something for you to keep in mind. If we can,
yeah.
if you can add something maybe to the experiment to allow you to clearly distinguish the times, then it we might be able to use it later on, so
Okay.
you don't have to run the experiments again. I mean, keep in mind what is the message of the paper, right? I mean, the message of the paper is that we have power savings with not too much impact on the CDF of the latencies, right? And if one question that the reviewer might ask is, what is the impact of the synchronization on the foreground latencies? If we can answer that additional question, that would help the paper.
Okay.
So, Akshat, do you have any comments in regarding this?
No, that seems okay to me. Yeah, nothing to add.
Okay, so anything else, Lewis?
No, that's fine. That's all I have.
Okay, so let's talk briefly about the paper itself. So I think Ricardo, you're going to give me some numbers for the figures, right? In section two, which is the motivation section,
Motivation, yeah.
which is for
Yes.
mainly for figure one. And
Yes. Yeah, as soon as it finishes, I'll commit and send your name.
okay, and for figure three, I guess Akshat is going to do something about it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So then, in terms of the revisions, I think section five is where I'm stuck at right now. I'm trying to figure out how to interpret these algorithms. So the first thing is that equation one needs to be changed, right?
Yeah,
Equation one is based on our discussions over email.
that is now C1 by so the current term plus a C3 divided by the stability of the working set.
Or times or multiplied by stability. So if it's more stable, it should be greater probability to switch off.
So I'll probably just put with the stuff that's there in the simulator right now, and if we are getting the numbers with that, we probably have to stick to that.
Okay. Yeah, because it's hard to define what is stability of working set. If we have something which is simpler, it'll be easier.
Yeah, so it is the number of misses. That's what I think it's being used. C3 by number of misses. So if the number of misses are large, then essentially are not going to give priority to that particular one. Just
So, are you looking at number or the rate or miss ratio or something like that?
Let me take a look at it. I think it's the number of misses and not the ratio, because I think it's the number of misses. The reason I went for that was your number of hits really don't matter much, because for every miss you have to anyways get the disk back on. So even if you're getting 900 of 100 hits but only one miss, you need to you really are getting to pay that penalty. So I think that's what I have.
I see. So in some sense, it should probably also be qualified by the number of spindles that these misses are going towards, right? So misses per spindle or something like that. Because if a VDISC is composed of 10 spindles, then and another VDISC composed of two spindles, then somehow normalize that or something like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think VDISC is not the right thing. MDISC, right? And
Yeah,
that's
MDISC is the right thing. Yeah.
yeah. So okay, yeah. So that. All right. So So misses per spindle or something like that. So yeah, so that's you know, for me, I had a hard time, you know, just reading through the bipartite graph creation section, and I don't think I still understand the exact algorithm based on the description. And the recalibration section also. So I don't know if there is a way to simplify this, or maybe write it differently or something. Or maybe if you can walk me through this in a more simplified fashion, I can help rewrite it.
Okay, so maybe let me try to do it quickly here. So if we go to figure 6.
Yeah, so there is this. So one thing which I was going to, yeah, so here you're also including the discussion on sub-replicas, right?
Yeah, so I have just taken out the discussion on sub-replicas just to make it simple to understand. That's why I, even in what I wanted to do was in 4 and 5, take out the sub-replicas and keep it as a separate subsection.
Right. So, but in section 5, I think they're mixed together.
Yeah, there's one place where it is there. We can even take it out from there. It's in bipartite graph creation. The last paragraph, the last couple of lines, actually have it.
Right.
So maybe ignore that. Maybe we can take it out.
Okay.
And
that would help simplify to some extent.
Yeah, that we should do. In which case, we'll have to probably move like this 4.6 to somewhere else. After 5, so that we can cover everything at the same place and doesn't really break. I mean, it's factually correct as well.
So, I agree.
So if you look at figure 6, it's really very straightforward. So what you do is you initially set WIJs to be the same as PIs. That's your initialization step, and on the left side you have like your.
So in the figure, I think we need to, for instance, specify if these are M disk or V disk, right? On the left side, do we have V disk, and on the right side we have M disk, something like that.
Yeah, there's more to that actually. So on the left side you have like your source, and the right side you have the targets. And both of them are actually in some sense, so on the left side you can think of as V-disk, and the right side you can think of as the target M-disks. And yeah, it's complicated because right now the figure also has sub-replicas and all, so we'll probably have to change that.
Yeah, because the discussion talks about V-disk and M-disk, but the figure is not clear on that angle.
So I'll probably take a pass on that. I had not looked at it for some time.
Yeah, if you can, you know, I have some comments on paper, but if you can maybe look at it once to make the figure and the text more synchronized, that would probably help. Because I think a reader, even someone who's a little bit more familiar with the algorithm, I'm having a hard time, you know, connecting these two.
So let me take a shot at this part. If you have, so... I guess the initial M disk ordering is clear, and
Clearer, because we wanted to show that, well, this module could be even could be a part of the virtualization manager, or it could be outside, right? Potentially, but we are specifying all the interfaces for communication between this SRC map module and the virtualization manager. So I wasn't sure if that was you were in agreement with that modification.
Okay. So I'll probably take a look at it and just verify. The second comment was on parade, right? So
I think parade. The amount of data that extra space required.
Yes. So I did not look at the equation very closely, but the what I did was I did look at so the logic. Let me try to bring the logic in a couple of lines and see if you agree. I'll anyway plan to maybe we can add a formal proof, even though we'll not include it in the paper. But just
so here the they have an approximate measure of the extra space, which they specify as d, or rather n minus g1 divided by n minus g1. Right, n minus g1 divided by n minus 1.
Yeah.
And n is the total number of disks. G1 is the number of disks at the lowest gear.
Mm-hmm.
Gear 1. So you could, in fact, have, in the best case, maybe two disks in the lowest gear for the reliability of tolerating one failure. And n could be as large as you want to. So based on this, approximately twice the extra space, twice or as much space as you already using.
Yeah, I'm not particularly convinced, simply because if you let's say take like a five disk example, then, and let's say in that you create four gears.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the fifth disk, that data has to be replicated on the first four, right? So for the first gear, for the first change, and then what happens with the fourth disk? That has to be replicated on the first three. So if you just go by that, then you see the data is going to be replicated almost like twice, which is fine, but there's more to it. So once you have replicated the data on the fifth disk on first four, in addition to that replication, what you also need to include is that the data of the fifth disk that's available on the fourth disk. So let's say that fifth disk had eight blocks and you put two blocks on each on the first four, then even the last two blocks on the fourth disk, that has to be replicated on 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
So if you just try to formulate it, it is almost like one plus. So it's more like on the last disk, the data on the fourth disk, you can think of it as 1/4, right? So 1/4 data has to be replicated again.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, for the third disk, you look at it, then it had 1/3 to start with. So now 1/3 has to be replicated again, and so on. So if you do, it's basically nothing else but a harmonic series. So if you have n disk with n minus 1 gears, let's say,
mm-hmm.
then you will have nothing else but 1 plus sigma 1 by n minus 1.
I see. I see. So you're saying it's more like n log n or something.
Log n, yeah.
So you had just log n in the previous version.
Okay.
So
Yeah,
that.
so what I meant was a login factor. So if you are using space 100 kilobytes, then it's basically log of 100 kilobytes or whatever. So it's into 100. So it's a factor of log n.
It's a factor of log n. Okay. I see. Okay, yeah. So because what I came up with was, I thought there was a higher number than what you had in there.
Okay.
So, but in fact, it turns out that you had a higher number already than what I came up with. So, yeah. So I do see what you mean now by the factor of log n rather than just additional log n space. Is that's a completely different estimate of the space. In the paper, though, they have this approximation formula which gives you at most 2x, right? 2n or whatever, twice the amount of space as before.
Yeah, so I did not look at that very closely, although I can see it says around and all that, approximate and all that. So let me take a second look at this and see if I miss something.
Okay. Yeah, well, if it's a factor of log n, I see where you're going with that calculation, and it seems to make sense to me. But yeah, if you can take another look at that, so we have the right information there, because you might end up with having some Parade folks or very familiar with Parade folks reviewing our paper.
Yeah.
Okay, so was there any other comment? Yeah, so I think that's all I had to discuss about the paper. You said that you had something to discuss about the organization of the background section, right?
Yeah, so background and motivation. Yeah, I understand background is very small. So
because I did move some part of that to the architecture, because I thought that we were discussing about our stuff and not really background. Which is the first paragraph of the section 4, which was earlier in the background section.
Okay. Yeah, so I actually saw two options here. One is to merge background and related work. So so like 3.2 becomes related work. And have section 2 as section 3 and section 3 as section 2. So we start with intro, then a background, and then the whole motivation business, and then followed by architecture. That was one flow. The other flow is, I guess, just merge the motivation and the background. The one that you're suggesting, right? So,
yeah. So the reason I want three sections of introductory material before we go into the actual system, because the reviewer might get lost in some of the background related stuff before he gets to our stuff. And that's why I sort of moved the related work until later. In some sense, the related work is not so critical for us to put in upfront. And if it is not helping build up directly the things that we are proposing, then we could postpone it until later.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense. I was not absolutely clear on how important related work is. So that's why, yeah, I was kind of confused whether to put it at the end. And I completely agree. If it's not really helping us position the paper, related work has to be at the end.
Yeah, I think it's better that it's at the end, because, if you put it up front, then a lot of things that we are doing have some similarities to one of those techniques, right? And then the reviewer might think, oh yeah, but this is like this and this is like that and so on. And I don't know if we want to put him in that position up front, because what we are proposing is in fact quite different. And yes, you can pick and choose portions of what we are doing and map it to one of the existing techniques, but as a whole, it's different, right? So.
Yeah, that's fine. So what you're saying is merge section 2 and 3, right? So make it a single section.
Exactly.
Motivation. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And then section 4 will become section 3 and so on.
Yeah. Makes sense.
All right. So Anyhow, so I'll continue working on the motivation because I think that needs another revision. And the motivation and background, I'll merge them and so on. And maybe, Akshat, you can do one pass on section 5.
Yeah.
And I'll work on section 6 with Ricardo and Lewis.
Okay.
Okay, and and once we have start getting some of the figures, we should start populating the text for the results section also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm hearing that Lewis will start having some results by tomorrow. And so I think it would be good to start making graphs as we collect numbers. So we know exactly which graphs are complete, which ones are not, and so on.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Any other matters or to discuss?
No.
No.
So when should we meet next? On Friday or? Actually, Friday this time doesn't work for me.
Yeah, actually, it doesn't work for me as well.
Thursday?
Okay, we could do Thursday. Sure.
Yeah. Let's do Thursday.
Okay, let's do Thursday then. All right. And then maybe if we need to meet again, we can meet on Saturday or Sunday or something like that.
Okay.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. All right, same time Thursday then.
Okay.
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 Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.